From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Today, go big or go home. We've got a couple of stories about unusual record breakers that transformed unremarkable activities into intense competitions. And if you're from New Hampshire like I am, you probably already know this first tale. It starts in a town called Keene. Now, Keene is the quintessential New England college town. And for years, every fall, tens of thousands of people flocked to Keene for their pumpkin festival. And when I say festival, I'm talking Bonnaroo level. This pumpkin fest was huge, and it was Keene's crowning jewel for 24 years. Until one day, when things took a turn.
There were rumors that people had been shot.
And, like, I just felt it in my hip. I was like, ugh. Like,
there was rumors that someone had died.
Like, I just got shot.
Here to tell the story is producer Megan Tan.
Hello, hello, hello.
So where do we begin?
In the early 90s.
This is not just a campaign for the presidency. It is a campaign for the future. God bless you, and thank you very much.
So Clinton was running for presidency, Mariah Carey just released her single, and at the time, in the early 90s, Keene's downtown was looking pretty rough.
This beautiful downtown was empty.
This is Nancy Sporborg. She's petite, short hair, and she is basically the mother of this pumpkin festival.
There just weren't a lot of people downtown. There wasn't life. There wasn't the store. A lot of the stores had closed. And it just looked kind of run down and lonely.
Now, one thing you need to know about Nancy is she is from Keene, and she loves Keene. So when she saw her depressed downtown, she wanted to do something to make it better. And her big idea? Pumpkins.
I love pumpkins. And I think that there's something about putting a candle in a pumpkin that is just, it's kind of like the light comes out of the darkness. Kind of that simple, beautiful light in life. That's what this is.
This was Nancy's dream, to transform Keene's downtown with something simple, a candle and an orange gourd. But it wasn't that easy. She definitely had a lot of convincing she had to do in town. But Nancy's persistent. So eventually, the town gave her the go-ahead, and she had permission to host Keene's first pumpkin festival.
There were families everywhere. Kids were all dressed up in their Halloween costumes.
I mean, it was really quaint and beautiful.
They all had little trick-or-treat bags. They went and trick-or-treated in all the downtown stores.
It was really enjoyable to look at all the pumpkins.
There were pumpkins literally everywhere, all along the ground, all around Central Square, on ladders, on hay bales, everywhere.
There's a sense of wonderment. A sense of kind of recollection of childhood that you get by going to this festival.
It was really, really special. It was special because people got to participate in something with community. It really felt like community.
The town loved it, and Nancy wanted to push it even further.
A local resident is asking everyone to bring a lit pumpkin to the downtown area tonight.
She's hoping more than 1,000 jack-o'-lanterns will be on display. There's no record for lit pumpkins in the Guinness Book of World Records, but Keene hopes to be the first.
We are trying to set a Guinness Book of World Records by having the largest number of lit jack-o'-lanterns in one place at one time.
Okay, so this may sound a little far-fetched, but the town was into it.
There, you gotta sign them in.
People brought pumpkins in by the carloads. And finally, the city of Keene accomplished something it had never done before.
And they came to a new benchmark for the Guinness World Book of Records. And the number is 1,628.
All of a sudden, I would go someplace. I'd go to a conference or I'd go to a meeting in some other place. And they'd say, where are you from? I'd say, oh, I'm from Keene, New Hampshire. They'd go, oh, that's that place that has that pumpkin festival thing.
And all of a sudden, Keene is in all of these different publications across the country. Yankee Magazine, Country Living Magazine, USA Today. It was also in Fox News, HGTV did a special on it, and they keep breaking this world record. In 1993, Keene brought in 4,817 pumpkins. The year after that, 10,540 pumpkins. In 1996, 13,044 pumpkins. In 1998, 17,693 pumpkins. In 2000, 23,727. 2012, 29,381. Oof. And as local resident and Pumpkin Festival volunteer Mike Giacomo describes it,
every spot of grass on Central Square and on Main Street has a pumpkin on it. You can't even tell where there's lawn and where there's not. You know the sidewalks only because that's where the pumpkins stop.
There were so many pumpkins that people were bringing down that they would write messages on them, like, Kate, will you marry me? In pumpkins.
It kind of took the place of Thanksgiving around here. Like, all the college kids came back to visit their parents. Not at Thanksgiving. A pumpkin festival. Oh, I love it.
But with more pumpkins came more people.
You feel the Main Street just tightening on you as you're walking down there. You can feel the shoulders getting closer and closer together as the hours of the day go on. It's just mob.
Even though the festival moved from being an event for the community, it became an event that the community put on for the world. We opened up our doorsteps to anybody and everybody who wanted to come. So that was always my answer to the size thing. I never felt like it got too big.
But it did get big. Every single year when Keene had its pumpkin festival, they were basically tripling and quadrupling the size of the town. And people in town didn't like it.
It became just so big and ungainly to me that it didn't interest me to spend time there.
At some point, snipers were starting to show up on the rooftops, and it wasn't fun to go down anymore.
But the pumpkin festival kept going, and it kept getting bigger and bigger.
Tonight, the people around the world are waiting for us. They want to know what our count is. Tonight, this is the center of America. This is what people care about. Tonight, we have achieved 30,500.
In 2013, Keene lit more pumpkins than it had in its whole history, with 30,581 pumpkins. But that same year, while part of the city was celebrating its victory, on the other side of town, there was also something not so victorious happening.
There was a time when it started feeling bigger, not in the number of people, but bigger in that it had big world problems.
Remember the other thing that Keene is known for, Keene State College? Well, less than a mile from this pumpkin festival is Keene's campus. Over the years, Keene State students were also developing their own tradition, Halloween parties. And in 2013, there were a couple of parties that got out of control. House parties were spilling out onto the street. People were on rooftops throwing beer bottles, getting injured.
And the people that were organizing the festival saw this and said, ooh, we have a critical mass of people that no longer care about their surroundings. And that was when I started saying, huh, I started to see the darker side of having that many people in one place.
So after this happened, Mike went downtown to the college bars because he wanted to talk to these students.
We had a booth set up with a bunch of free t-shirts, and if someone came up and chatted with us, we'd give them a free t-shirt that I think it said, "Don't lose your head," and has a picture of a jack-o'-lantern on it. And just trying to encourage the college students to behave themselves during the festival. But there were a couple people that came up and were really a lot more antagonistic than I had expected. We had one gentleman come up, and his comment to us was, "Keene is nothing without Keene State. You guys need us, and the point of the Pumpkin Festival is to party." And that was the point at which I realized that the 2014 festival is going to be in trouble.
Welcome. This is an exciting day. I am thrilled to see so many people at the start of the festival. As the day goes along, there will be thousands and thousands more.
During the 2014 festival, people like Mike and Nancy were a little on edge because they didn't really know what was going to happen.
There was really no problems. The festival was absolutely the best, most perfect festival I'd ever been to in 2014 on the footprint of the festival.
I mean, there were, I don't know how many thousands of people downtown, tens of thousands of people downtown, everybody having a wonderful time. It was a great event. And all of a sudden, Ruth came over to me and she said, "Nancy, look around, this might be your last one."
Good evening, I'm Caitlin Flint, live in Keene, New Hampshire, where we have been here as police continue to try to contain the crowds in this area where they escalate.
So, like, I got out of class on Thursday and like, immediately started drinking. I think I've been drinking, like, since, like, noon that day.
I know at Pumpkin Fest is coming, so I'm like, all right, I gotta get some alcohol. I got two handles of Ciroc, so I'm ready.
Cousin arrived, and he was already drinking. That's when I started drinking.
I mean, I just remember thinking to myself, like, oh, I know that this is gonna be, like, the craziest, craziest weekend. So we were all, like, at this one big party, and there must have been at least like 600 or 700 people in this one backyard. Just an absolute sea of people. Beer bottles getting chucked up in the air. I just remember like seeing my friend walk up to me, like his face was just like covered in blood, and I was like, "Dude, what's wrong? Like, what happened?" And he's like, "Oh, a bottle hit him in the face."
There was rumors that someone had died. There were rumors that people had been shot.
And, like, I just felt it in my hip. I was like, like I just got shot. This little thing, like, falls through the air and lands on the ground. And it just goes, psst. I was like, tear gas. Like, I gotta get the out of here. So I just, like, started running in, like, any direction that I could.
The speculation was wild all over the place. And so, of course, our reaction is, oh my gosh, the festival's done. This is the end.
Right now, hard questions are being asked after an outbreak of violence in Keene, New Hampshire.
That mayhem began in broad daylight at the annual Pumpkin Fest.
Especially when we started finding out it's on CNN.
Police in riot gear had to use tear gas to try to disperse rowdy partiers.
It's on Fox News. It's on all the local stations, of course, had it already. And suddenly Keene stopped being the town that has the Pumpkin Festival. And it started becoming Keene, the place with the riots fueled by a festival about a gourd.
That weekend, about 140 arrests were made. And the city of Keene said it cost them $150,000.
I had a great time. Like, no matter, like, getting shot at, like, running from the cops, like, seeing people's, like, heads getting bashed in by police batons, like, it was crazy and scary, but, like, it was, like, pretty, like, exhilarating, and, like, it was just, like, rebellion, like, against the system, like, it was crazy. I mean, but I don't know, like, obviously, it was pretty terrible, like, I feel like it's been like this for a while.
Maybe it had been like this for a while. this wasn't the first time a group of students had a big party during the weekend of the Pumpkin Festival. But it might be the last.
Well, Tom, this is definitely a community divided over the fate of Pumpkin Fest. People living near campus say the riot was just the culmination of...
Keene had to make a decision if they were going to continue the Pumpkin Festival or not. And leading up to this decision, the city hosted multiple forums, and this was the first one.
Keene citizens must work together.
In an auditorium, over 200 people showed up. Nonprofits, government officials, college staff members, students, the city councilors, and the founder, Nancy Sporborg, they were all there.
People came from everywhere. We had a woman from Massachusetts who talked about coming to the festival every single year. We had this grandfather who said, "What am I going to say to my grandchildren?"
As people walked up one by one and stood in front of a microphone to express their opinions, the divide that had been quietly growing within the city for years started to come out.
We can't shut down Pumpkin Fest because it's who we are. It's what we do.
I do believe that the Pumpkin Festival has achieved the status of attractive nuisance.
As far as Pumpkin Fest itself, I would really hate to see it go. I remember carving pumpkins with my two little girls. They were still toddlers.
I had to spend 4.5 hours on that particular evening standing on my front porch guarding my property from people who were intoxicated, drunk, and having a good time.
Exemplary people. That's why this Pumpkin Festival has captured the hearts of people around the world. And we can do this.
After multiple forums, the city council had to choose. If they were going to let It Shine, the organization that puts on the Pumpkin Festival, host it again next year or not. And you have to keep in mind that these people also grew up with the Pumpkin Festival. They've seen it in its entirety and have volunteered there themselves. So this was a pretty hard decision.
A yes vote tonight will be to carry out the committee report. A no vote will be to oppose the committee report. All those in favor of the committee report. The action of the City Council tonight, the action that's just been taken, is to deny a license to Let It Shine for the continuation of a Pumpkin Fest to be held in 2015.
I never felt that they were going to shut it down until they shut it down, because I think I believed in my heart that they would rise above.
The vote was almost unanimous. It was 13-1 against the festival. And that was it.
It's not just a silly festival. I mean, it has meaning. Everybody wants to be a part of something bigger than themselves. Everybody does. Everybody wants to know that their contribution matters. Everybody does. And this event was a way for us to do that. This was bringing back the light in my life and in downtown Keene and in the, for the community. So it has a lot of deep meaning for me.
It's kind of sad that it's like not happening anymore, because it was like a community thing more than anything, but I don't know. We kind of ruined it.
So wait. So are you guys? Are you guys sad that it is not here anymore?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, like, even though it was like a party thing, like it's still sad because that was like a cool like event, because like everyone knew about it and like it was a good weekend to like bring people together, and now it's like gone. Yeah.
I mean, it was nice to like be able to say that was our sort of holiday, but you know. What can you do? I mean, we would have, if we had had it this year, I guarantee it would have been like very, like probably pretty bad too, inevitably.
Wait, why do you guys say that?
I don't know, because it's like people are stupid. Like they're not going to.
People see last year as like, oh, if we can do that, what can we do this year?
If we can do this year, what can we do next year? It's a common phrase. And one that I heard from both the college students and from Nancy.
That was producer Megan Tan. Keene's Pumpkin Festival may be over, but Laconia, just 80 miles away, held its first pumpkin festival the following year. They even managed to get 10,000 lit jack-o'-lanterns. This year, wind and rain cut that number in half. Organizers have said they're not trying to beat Keene's record, but if they ever get within spitting distance, you know what they'll be thinking. If we could do that this year, what could we do next year? Coming up, a sporting legend takes down one of the greatest records of all time.
Are you kidding me?
The North American birding record.
So I can hear American robins in the background. Chickadees, black-capped chickadee.
Magisterial, Leona! Magnifico! Extraordinario!
We'll pick up a pair of binoculars with the LeBron James of birdwatching when Outside In continues. This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it, from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Today, go big or go home. And the next story is all about going big on something very small. Birding.
So I can hear American robins in the background.
Birding, if you're not a birder, seems slow.
Chickadees, black-capped chickadee, which is the state bird for my state of Massachusetts.
And this might look calm, tranquil, meditative.
I think it's the state bird for almost every other state as well.
But what you're actually observing here is a sport. And the competition can be pretty intense.
If you're going to do it on a national scale, on a continental scale, the money involved is vast. And I can't play that game.
That last voice belongs to Eric Masterson, our go-to guide to birding culture. He works for the Harris Center for Conservation Education here in New Hampshire.
I enjoyed it, but I just lost interest in that. I was like, what's the point? You know, there's got to be some reason, some driving force behind this that's a little bit more noble than just building a list.
Eric is what you might call a bird enthusiast. He can identify birds, and he'll spend parts of his weekend birdwatching, but he doesn't really fall into this subculture of extreme birdwatching, which is a competitive sport which causes birders to obsessively crisscross the United States and Canada in airplanes, abandon their loved ones for weeks on end while they huddle on windblown Alaskan islands, hoping for bad weather to blow birds across the Pacific Ocean. Neil Hayward falls into that category.
I think we're supposed to go that way, but it doesn't look like we're allowed. Let's have a look. Song sparrow flying past.
In 2013, Neil Hayward was depressed. He had just left a biotech company that he had helped to start, but got kind of bored with, and he was getting over the end of a very serious relationship. And suddenly, he found himself doing a lot of birding.
Because I had so much free time that year, I could end up staying, I could put in a lot of hours and wait for birds. And that always paid off. I waited for 8 hours for a hummingbird in southeast Arizona. And just as the sun was setting, this bird came in. And I'd been sitting outside through 2 thunderstorms and rain, and was about to give up, and it was just the end of a great day.
If sitting still in the rain for 8 hours doesn't sound like a great day to you, you are not ready to join the ranks of the nation's best birders. Neil, who lives in Boston, is one of the birding elite. Back in 2013, when he was feeling depressed, he decided to do something birders call a big year, trying to see as many species of birds in the U.S. and Canada as he possibly could in 12 months. The first bird he saw that year? A lowly Canada goose.
Things like sparrows, we get really excited about sparrows, all look very similar, and they're pretty drab, and to a non-birder, you might reasonably ask, you know, what's all the fuss about? But I think it's those birds that have some subtlety. Those are the ones that I think take more time and I guess, ultimately more rewarding.
So let's just start with, why birds? I mean, why is birdwatching so popular that it is actually an activity that we've all heard of? You don't hear about people going reptile watching, even though that is a thing. There are people who do this. It's called herping, as in herpetology?
You know, in New England, there's only like 5 or 6 species of frog, so it doesn't take very long to see them all. whereas birding is like almost like the ideal number. You know, you could spend your whole life birding in North America and see new birds every year.
Bird watching is big. Like 60 million people told the census they are bird watchers big. That's more than, say, they play basketball. And within that 60 million, there are, of course, varying degrees of enthusiasm. Some just do it in their backyards, but there are tens of millions of people who travel, who actually go places just to see different birds. These are people who keep lists. Lists of birds they've seen in a given state, in a given country, in this year, and in their whole life. Lots of lists. And it's a different kind of person who's attracted to this variety of birding.
And I think a lot of birders are probably, they like bringing order to the universe, and like collecting is one way of doing that, categorizing things. It's that same kind of mentality.
Certain people end up birders. I've seen characteristics and character traits prevalent amongst a lot of the birders that I know. You throw in a little bit of anxiety, throw in a little bit of obsessive compulsion, throw in a little bit of overachievement. I don't know, maybe my next career is going to be some sort of psychoanalytic, take a master's in psychoanalysis and figure out what it is that drives birders. But I'm actually serious. I think there's something to that.
You could open a practice and just focus on helping birders heal.
Yeah, and I'd be broke.
So let me tell you how the extreme variety of elite birding works. Birds are on the wing, on the move. You never know what you'll see. Who knows? Maybe it'll be something from the other side of the Atlantic that blew its way over here in a storm. When a bird shows up outside of its typical range, birders notice. Now, this doesn't have to be a rare bird. It could be the most common bird ever. We could be talking about a robin, but if it shows up somewhere it's not supposed to be, suddenly it's a rarity. They call this a vagrant, and word starts to spread.
Pagers start ringing, texts go out.
Email list servers start to light up, blogs are updated.
Instant communication.
It doesn't matter what time of day, it doesn't matter what day of the week, birders drop everything.
And, you know, you're talking about lying to the boss to take a sick day, which... you know, it's people do.
Eric remembers two instances of this happening that were kind of extreme. Once in Ireland, when a rather common American bird showed up.
There were jets that were chartered from as far away as Geneva for this thing.
And privately
chartered jets. Get a few people together to privately charter a flight. This bird generated, for that local economy, in the order of several hundred thousand euro.
And this is not a European phenomenon. Earlier this year in New Hampshire, someone spotted a European redwing. Again, in Europe, this is a pretty common bird. More than 500 birders from all over the country dropped everything to fly here.
Now, you picture Hollis High School. Hollis High School, right? And it was actually, you know, we're in an era where if you have 500 middle-aged men with optics descending on a high school, it kind of rings alarm bells.
Confused police officers, disgruntled neighbors, this is what extreme birdwatching looks like. And this is the game that Neil Hayward decided he was going to play. For an entire year, he was glued to birding forums and listservs, waiting for rare bird alerts and chasing them whenever they arrived. Just as an example of the kind of behavior this leads to, once Neil heard that a blue-footed booby, which is normally a Mexican bird, had just landed in New Mexico.
And I flew to Dallas. When I got on the plane in Boston, the bird was still being seen. Numerous reports, lots of birders very happy. And I got to Dallas at midnight and turned my phone on and had a text message from a local birder saying that the bird had gone into rehab. It was emaciated. It wasn't eating.
Even if Neil had been able to get in to see the bird, which he probably could not have, captive birds don't count. They have to be wild.
So I had to get back on the plane that night, 4 o'clock in the morning, flew back to Boston. So obviously a upsetting trip, but obviously more upsetting for the booby.
Neil spent tens of thousands of dollars on his big year and racked up 250,000 frequent flyer miles, spent many, many weeks away from home. And while Neil did his big year, he was also falling in love.
Last year we did a trip down to Central America, and we also stayed in this canopy tower that was just set above the canopy of the rainforest, and that's something that I never thought I would do in my life.
Jerry Hayward is now Neil's wife. Now, this might strike you as a difficult way to live if you wanted to live with another person, but I think very often significant others of birders become de facto birders themselves.
But he's also taken me to a lot of trash dumps in New Jersey and Connecticut. You know, yeah, those were some of our first dates, so.
As December rolled around in Neil Hayward's big year, he was only 8 birds shy of the record of seeing 748 birds in a single year. He had spent weeks on end on weather-beaten Alaskan islands way out in the Bering Sea trying to spot Asian birds that had been blown off course. He'd been to the islands all the way out at the very end of the Florida Keys called the Dry Tortugas. He'd been to the Canadian Rockies, the American Rockies, the Santa Rita Mountains, the Appalachian Mountains, and countless wildlife refuges and state parks. But he says it was only right there at the very end of the year that he thought, hey, I might beat the record. I might see more birds in the U.S. and Canada in a year than anyone else has ever.
The record was 748. There's a couple of mallards flying in front of us.
See? He never stops birding.
So yeah, at the beginning of December, I was on sort of low 740s. And that was exciting. I mean, and I thought, there's a good chance that I won't beat the record. And then does that mean that this is all a failure? That, you know, that I didn't do what I was supposed to do?
As those final 30 days are ticking down, Neil is traveling frantically from Texas way out into the Aleutian Islands, then to California and to Florida, and then way up north to Homer, Alaska, trying to find those last 8 birds. Finally, he ends the big year on a boat off the coast of North Carolina, where he saw a great skua.
At the end of the year, I hadn't beaten the record, and I was still waiting for a couple of those ABA firsts that had never been seen before to be accepted.
And so this is the final thing you need to know about elite birding. If you had any doubt as to whether this is actually a sport, guess what? There are referees.
Oh, the Grand American Birding Association. they're the group that sort of manages the US and Canadian list.
There are birds that count and birds that don't. If you see a bird that's not on the list, you'd better have a camera with you. You'd better get a good photo. Neil saw a Eurasian sparrowhawk and spent all day trying to get a good picture by holding his iPhone camera up to his telescope lens. But ultimately, the ABA rejected his sighting. He also saw an American condor. Remember, condors had been nearly wiped out and then were released back into the wild, and their population was rebounding. But according to the ABA rules,
they hadn't been in the wild for long enough. Ironically, the year afterwards, then they were added to the list. So if I'd done my big year in 2014, then I would have been able to count that.
So birding. It's got rules. It's got fierce competition, though it's largely on the honor system. And it's got superstars. Eventually, Neil Hayward's big year was declared the biggest ever. A common red start and a rufous-necked wood rail that he saw were both accepted by the ABA, and he broke the big year record by one bird in June of 2015. Neil's record didn't stand for long, though. This year, there are 2 birders who have already passed his mark, and a third might still get there. I talked to Neil before hearing this news, and so I called him up. And he pointed out he actually got a late start and didn't get going in earnest until April.
So this doesn't stir any desire in you to start over again next year and actually start at January 1st?
when I started doing my big year, I told people that I would never do a big year. The whole idea of it sounded crazy and just kind of insane and a lot of work, a lot of travel. And I said I would never do that. And I ended up doing it. So even though now I say I will never go back and do it again, who knows?
Yeah. We are creatures that we do ourselves do not understand.
Mm-hmm.
If If you want to hear more stories about crazy birding, Neil Hayward wrote a book about his big year. It's called Lost Among the Birds. Between its covers, you'll find much more about the odd and wonderful culture of birding. And hey, you might learn some things about individual birds, too.
Hey, Sam.
Hey.
It's that time again.
That time again? That sounds awful.
God.
Let's be more excited about it. It's that time again.
Hit it, Taylor.
Why do geese make V's?
Does a bumblebee sneeze?
Can a person eat trees?
Can a polar bear freeze?
Is a kidney stone kind of like a pearl in a clam?
Well, I don't know. Ask Sam.
All right, Sam. So I'm here with Taylor, and we have exciting news that someone called in to the Ask Sam hotline.
I actually know this because she called my voicemail, and then I had to forward it to the Ask Sam hotline.
Oh, did you? Oh, she did a deep dive and got your personal number.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened. But we stopped you before you listened to it. So this is fresh. This
yes,
is the first
yeah,
time.
Yeah. I only heard the first little bit.
All right. We'll see if you're ready. Here it goes.
My name is Margot, and I am calling from Bethlehem, New Hampshire. I was getting off the interstate in Lincoln, and at the exit stop sign, there was a blue-winged teal on the ground in the triangle, and it looked very nervous, like looking around, and I thought it would fly off when the car stopped, and it looked at me, but it didn't move, and I didn't know what was wrong with it. I thought maybe it couldn't fly, and then all of a sudden, a crow came down, like attacking it, squawking, and the teal flew off. And I watched this crow following this teal, and the teal was like zigzagging around in the air, and the crow was squawking and attacking at it. And then it landed, and the crow did the same thing again, came down at it, squawking. And I'd never seen a crow attacking a duck before. So I just wondered if this is some common thing that's happened before, if this is a really unusual event. Thank you. I hope you have an answer.
Well, I'm glad she gave us a clue that a teal is a duck.
I know. Did she say a duck or a dove?
I thought she said duck, but you know, I guess we're going to find out. This is like a good moment to note that I'm like the worst birder ever. We went out with Neil. We were looking at birds, and I was like, oh, what's that bird? And he's like, that's a robin. And like, what's that next bird? That's a sparrow. You know, like basic birds sometimes elude me. So, yeah, I have no idea.
I just know crows are nasty. Like, they were training them to track down terrorists. Because they have face recognition. They're really smart. If you Google attack crows, you'll find it.
So do you think that this crow had a personal vendetta against
or
this duck?
Or was trained. Maybe it wasn't personal, but it was someone else's vendetta against the duck.
It was like hired?
A duck-killing crow.
All right, well, I better go Google attack crows.
I should do another version of the theme where it's like, ask Sam and he'll ask someone else. Ask Sam and he'll call someone who's actually an expert.
Okay, Maureen, I found your guy.
Well, some of my research was funded by the Army, and it was with the notion really not of hunting down Osama bin Laden, but really for trying to rescue people that were lost behind enemy lines or missing people for a variety of reasons. I don't think it went very far.
So I was kind of right.
You were kind of right, yeah. So they crows are really, really good at recognizing faces. And this gentleman, this is John Marsloff. He is famous for a study that he's been conducting for years in which they took a couple of crows and they captured them and just sort of pestered them, did annoying things that crows don't like. And they did this while wearing masks. One mask was a Dick Cheney mask and one mask was a caveman mask. The Dick Cheney mask was the control. They did not harass crows wearing the Dick Cheney mask. They harassed them using the caveman mask. They then released those crows out into the wild, and every year they'll like take an undergrad and make them wear the mask and go out onto the campus. And the crows, not only did the original crows that had been harassed remember the masks, but they then taught the other crows.
Whoa!
Yeah.
So they would like spread the word like, that's a bad dude.
Yeah, and they like caw at them and they'll sort of like swoop at them.
That's so awesome.
So he's the guy that we called about the duck question. What was the crow doing to this duck? And the answer is actually, I found quite surprising, which is that crows are predators.
They will seize upon you know, really any opportunity to get food. And that's one reason they are so successful around us in either agriculture or in the city, because they are flexible and they are able to take advantage of new situations. And maybe it's garbage one day or a duck the next. They are always looking for that that opportunity to get a meal.
A crow will eat a duck?
A crow will eat anything that it can get its crowy face on.
So it was trying to kill the duck. It wasn't just harassing.
Yeah, it wanted to eat it.
Whoa.
And so I asked him, like, how often are they hunting and, you know, being predators? He said maybe like 5% of their total calories will come from hunting and killing other animals, but that's more during the nesting season because they'll kill baby birds all the time because they're basically defenseless. And if you Google this, you can find all sorts of videos of crows trying to eat, especially baby ducks.
Oh, what a terrible genre of YouTube video that is.
Well, this took a depressing turn.
Who types that in? Crows eating baby ducks.
But okay, so then I asked him, what's the craziest thing you've seen a crow eating?
Well, there's kind of categories. I did see him eat vomit off the side of the wall here, not too far from this radio station, in fact. That's always kind of the grossest thing I've seen them eat. I've seen ravens eating molten plastic in dumps. Which are related to crows.
What?
And the more interesting things are these larger prey items. They routinely will chase down pigeons, or they will take advantage of situations where they can flush a bird into a window and then eat it after it's stunned, or even harass a squirrel to the extent that it runs out in traffic and gets run over. And I thought at first the question about the teal might relate to something like that. They were chasing a teal into traffic and then they were going to scavenge it. But it sounds like they were just trying to catch it straight out.
Whoa. Yeah.
Crows.
Cold-blooded. Wow.
That creeps me out. Think about Hitchcock's The Birds. Like, if they're that smart that they could chase a squirrel out, if they attacked in numbers,
they could start doing it to us.
Ugh.
They just have to, like, you know, swarm around your head, chase you into traffic. Boom.
Very disturbing.
Yeah.
So you could have, like, crow assassins.
Also probably trained somehow.
If you have a hit out on someone, that'd be, like, really, no one would ever find out.
So there you go.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Crows.
No more birds, no more pumpkins, no more records. When we come back, we're going to stop trying to go big and instead look for big stories in teeny little places.
You know, to really kill a soil, so to speak, you have to basically put it in a nuclear reactor for a while.
I have so many questions that's like, so okay.
Imagine for a moment that you're standing in anywhere USA, at the edge of a wide circle, a traffic circle. Two busy lanes of traffic curve around the circle in front of you, and highways stretch out in four different directions. A McDonald's squats squarely to your right.
Yeah, can I get an order of hash browns?
There's a Wendy's on your left. And in the middle, what appears to be the world's least interesting island, a boring patch of weedy grass surrounded by oceans of pavement. But let's grab a botanist.
Yeah, really interesting.
I'm just rolling.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Dash across the road.
There's no crosswalk.
I got it.
I think right now.
Yeah.
And take a closer look.
You know, it has the structure of a short grass prairie. It looks like something you'd see on the high plains of Montana or eastern Colorado. There's at least 20 different higher plant species out there. At least 20.
I'm Sam Evans Brown, and this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. Today, another edition of 10x10, where we take you on a journey to a 10x10 plot and uncover the secrets in spaces you'd never think to look. This time, we look for signs of extraordinary life at the center of an ordinary traffic circle. So honestly, if I were driving past a flat, treeless traffic circle and I said, hey, what's that stuff growing there? You'd say something like, it's called grass, Sam.
Big whoop.
But I'm here to blow your mind with some grass facts. Now, the human branch of the tree of life, the hominids, has 7 species. But grasses have 12,000 species. There are pretty grasses, gross grasses, tall grasses, golfy grasses, sea grasses. Grass, it's not just for lawns. And so while you might just see grass, our botanist, Tom Lee, sees multitudes. First and foremost, the weeds.
Mainly crabgrass. There's some quackgrass, another weed, the common ragweed over there, which causes...
Crabgrass, quackgrass, and that old standby.
Oh, look, dandelion. This is not on my list. I didn't see this yesterday, but this is...
Then there's the pretty stuff. The stuff you'd probably call wildflowers, but can be more accurately described as broadleaf herbs.
Brown-eyed Susans, and there's some kind of a coreopsis right here, and there's...
What's a coreopsis?
Wow, I missed this too. This is butter and eggs, Linaria vulgaris.
There are even a few plants that you might find at your farmer's market.
This is a species called wintercress, also known as yellow rock. It's not native, but it has these rather fleshy, succulent leaves, which I believe you can put in a salad. I wouldn't put these in a salad, but
maybe after a lot of washing.
Yeah.
And there is plenty of grass, like grass.
Well, I didn't see this yesterday. This is a little blue stem. In fact, this is the grass that does grow on the high plains. This is a native North American grass that would be a dominant species in the midgrass prairie of Nebraska and Kansas and on up into the Dakotas. And I'm surprised to see that here, but there it is.
So how did a little piece of Nebraska, miles and miles of earth and blue sky, little bees buzzing around, the proverbial home on the range, the actual place where the buffalo roam, how did a miniature version of this bucolic habitat find its way here? Lee estimates that of the 20 to 25 species that he could see on that traffic circle, only about 6 or 7 of them were intentionally planted. The rest somehow crossed this concrete moat on their own.
Isn't that kind of remarkable?
It is. It is remarkable. Some of them blew in on the wind. The fleabanes are like, and the dandelion have those little parachutes that carry them on a breeze. But then there are seeds like those of the evening primrose, which are small little barrel-shaped things that really aren't dispersed by wind at all. But my guess is they're carried on the bodies of vehicles on a rainy day with some mud splattered up on the side, driving through here, hitting a puddle. The seeds are washed off and sent flying into the center of the circle, and they germinate and grow.
So far, if we're looking for plant life in unexpected places, we're doing pretty well. But what about animals? As far as I could see, there were no cute little rabbits munching on the grass, no coyotes munching on the rabbits, pretty much just plants growing peacefully, quietly. Well, think again, because I've got one little word for you. Nematodes.
If we're talking about them in people, parasites of people, heartworm in dogs, those are nematodes. People don't like to talk about them, you know, but if you look at them in soil, they're pretty cool.
That's Diana Wall, a nematode expert and biology professor at Colorado University. And she's here to introduce us to the secret world of soil microbiology.
I got into it because I think it's one of the most fascinating areas of unknown on the planet.
Nematodes, by the way, are little roundworms, many of them smaller than an eyelash. And soils are teeming with them. Soils, in fact, are teeming with all sorts of crazy stuff.
We know now that almost every phylum, every major group of life above ground, is much reduced below ground. It still may be represented in the soil, but it's going to be at a much smaller size.
Remember the food web you used to study in grade school? The owl eats the shrew, that eats the grasshopper, that eats the leaf. You remember. Most food webs go no further than plants, but there's a whole nother food web, complete with tiny equivalents of herbivores and predators happening right beneath your feet.
Yeah, it's a jungle. It's just a jungle. Or you could just figure out it's a factory and say we're all trying to turn out every car that's ever been made in under one city block. I mean, they're bumping parts and they're moving around and they're passing things off.
This world may be small, but it's crowded, like really crowded.
Normally, in a garden variety soil, in a handful, you would have on the order of 200 billion or so organisms in the soil.
With a B.
200 billion with a B in a handful of soil.
The next time you're digging in the garden, think about that. There are around 28 times the number of organisms in every handful of soil than there are humans living on planet Earth.
And maybe of those 100 billion, you know, several thousand, tens of thousands of different species.
That, by the way, is our third and final scientist for today, UNH soil microbiologist Sarita Frey, who's here to tell us whether our dry, isolated little traffic circle is just as populated with life as a handful of garden soil. To find out, we'll need to take a few samples.
Soils are very heterogeneous, very highly variable from one place to another.
Highly variable even from here to 20 feet away.
From here to there.
Like 2 feet away.
Or even 2 centimeters away.
All right.
She rips out a handful of grass to expose the dirt and then takes a tulip bulb planter and grinds it down into the soil.
Already I can tell it's pretty sandy.
It's just dust under there.
Yeah.
So, it's really disheartening.
The next thing that I'll
if our aim here is to amaze you with just how much life there is in a traffic circle, this is not a good sign. A lot of soil organisms are technically aquatic animals. They want to live where it's nice and wet. And right now, this region is going through a pretty bad drought. But just as lots of woodland critters hibernate through the winter, many microorganisms have adapted to live under even the harshest environments. Here's Diana Wall.
You can put them under liquid nitrogen. You can put them in a freezer. You could keep them on your shelf for, I don't know, 60 years. I think they've kept some nematodes and just dried in a sack of on a shelf in a lab. And then you bring them back into the lab and say, hey, here's some water. And you can watch them come back to life.
After we get our samples, we run back across the road and head over to Frey's lab. She pops them into mason jars, adds a little water to bring the little buggers back to life, and then leaves it in the awesomely named environmental chamber.
Like a fridge, but whatever you want.
Which is basically a big, sterile, walk-in cooler that's not actually cold.
For this soil, I'm thinking we'll leave it in for a couple of days, and then we'll come back and measure the amount of carbon dioxide that has accumulated.
Just like us, microorganisms breathe in oxygen and exhale CO2. So we estimate how many critters there are just by analyzing the air in the jar.
I don't know if you want to do this or you want me to do it and talk you through it.
Can I do it?
Sure.
Okay, well, okay, all right.
For comparison, we put another sample in the chamber. One that Sarita took from her husband's backyard garden.
That's pretty easy. I feel like I could do this at home, except for the environmental chamber part.
You could.
3 days later, we brought both samples into the lab, extracted some of the air, and tested it for CO2 using an infrared gas analyzer.
Okay.
And lo and behold...
It's like the lead traffic circle might have more.
I think you're right.
Our sandy traffic circle samples showed more microbial activity than the fresh garden soil.
So it's more than twice as much at the Lee Traffic Circle. Wait, was that what you were expecting? Or were you expecting your husband's?
No, I was not expecting that.
Good job, Lee Traffic Circle.
Just to be clear, we're probably reading too much into these results.
So normally we would have multiple replicates, so we would have, you know, ideally 5 or 6 jars.
But still, in your face, garden soil. Come on, it's hard to not root for the underdog, right?
Soil is considered one of the most diverse habitats on the planet, even, you know, potentially more diverse than a rainforest in terms of the organisms that live there and the complexity of these relationships that you're talking about. And we just know so little about them.
Here's the thing. Even our rainforests have countless species that we have yet to discover, and those are big enough that we can walk around inside of them and look at the species in jars. So just imagine that under your feet, it's like there's a vast and endless rainforest that's too small to see.
Tens of thousands of species in a handful of soil, potentially, and less than 1 to 10% of those are known to science.
Less than 1 to 10% are known to science. And the crazy thing about this is all of those different species that we know nothing about, they're everywhere. Here in New Hampshire, in a traffic circle, we've got our own crazy world. Down in the Amazonian rainforest, they've got theirs. Diana Wall has even found soil microbes under the ice of Antarctica. So remember, next time you're driving on a boring stretch of highway and you round a dusty patch of overgrown grass, remember that the grass growing there may have hitchhiked for miles on the mud flaps of tractor trailers. Remember that there in the dirt, there are microscopic predators with no names, hunting for a prey that no human has ever seen. Outside In is produced by me, Sam Evans-Brown, Maureen McMurray, Taylor Quimby, Logan Shannon, Molly Donahue, Jimmy Gutierrez, and Megan Tan. If you've got a pressing question about crow attacks, unusual gourd shapes, or vampire nematodes, don't forget you can submit your own question to Outside In by calling the Ask Sam hotline. The number is 603-223-2448. And you can also check out our spooky, autumnally themed podcast exclusive on why the woods are so freaking scary. It's available at outsideinradio.org, or you can download it by subscribing to our podcast. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.